Welcome to the 77th episode of the Frank Online Marketing Show. I'm Tema Frank. Today I bring you two interviews that I've done at conferences that I attended recently. The first interview is with Diana Lukacs, the founder of True Impact Marketing, and she spoke at the recent Marketing Research and Intelligence Association National Conference in Saskatoon. What I found really fascinating about her work is that she looks at neuroscience and applies that to marketing, and how, by understanding the brain better, can we understand how to communicate and sell more effectively. So she was reporting on some of her research, and you'll find in this interview some tips that will help you get attention and help people remember your message. The second interview is with Jeff Bartow, who is the trust strategist at Symantec, and I interviewed him a while back at the ETEL Canada conference. We discuss security and its role in making people trust your website. And of course, if people don't trust you, they're not going to buy from you. So in the interview with him, he gives some tips for building trust online. I hope you enjoy the interviews, and I will chat with you very briefly at the end.
My name is Diana Lukacs, founder of True Impact Marketing and Canadian chair on the Neuromarketing Science and Business Association. Sorry, it's long. And today I had the opportunity to co-present with Yahoo a case study that we worked on with them and also Fresh Intelligence. And the topic or the theme was technology. What was the role of technology on memory? How does technology impact memory? And the study was a bigger project, of which neuroscience was one aspect of it. There was qual, quant, done, and we came in to measure emotion, which is what we specialize in, and leverage those insights and interpret those insights for them. What we did is we wanted to see how people remember an experience, like viewing a video, and so we used the EEG on a group of people while they were watching a video. Mm-hmm. They were watching, I believe it was a travel show, and another group of people were told that they can watch the video and also snap a picture of it. Both groups were told that they're going to be tested in the end, so they were trying to remember as much as they could about the details in the videos. And we measured their brain activity while they were watching the video. Then we measured how well they scored on a memory test. And then we measure their brain activity when they recall their experience of what they saw.
Before you get into the results on that, I'm curious when, if you're watching their brain activity through the whole time, when people made the decision to take a photo and were actively taking the photo, what changes did you see in activity?
We saw changes in their concentration levels.
Okay. So it went down.
Yeah, it did. Taking a photo is distracting, is the bottom line. And it distracts from remembering details in the video, and it affects the experience you have retelling that video. Mm-hmm. So you can take a photo, you're not concentrating as much, and then when it comes time to remember or to retell what you saw, you might not do such a good job, and you're not going to feel as excited about it because you were distracted. You don't have all the details, right?
Right.
So as opposed to the group who simply watched, their concentration was higher.
Mm-hmm.
When it came time to recollect what they saw, they had a more enjoyable experience recollecting it.
I go to conferences now, and the way I've taken to taking notes is by tweeting what mm-hmm. the key points that I'm hearing. First of all, if on a cell phone, I just find that takes me away too much from the lecture. But at least if I have a keyboard, I can do it. But I still sort of wonder, am I harming my memory or helping it by typing these notes? I mean, I asked a question about whether writing increases, and you said yes, it does, because you're using different parts of the brain basically to concentrate, I guess. What
yeah.
about something like typing and tweeting?
So the main difference in writing is that you're using your motor skills as well,
right,
to physically to write each word. So
right.
by the time you finish writing a word, it takes longer than typing it. You need to think ahead a little bit more. You need to have a structure for a sentence in your head for long enough to get it all down on paper, but also not miss what else is being said. So it takes a little bit more work to take physical notes.
Yes.
But if you're a student in school, you should do that because it helps you remember more than if you're simply typing your notes. Typing, people usually type faster than they write. And then when it's not physical, when it's not on a piece of paper in front of you, and I do, I did a couple of talks on this with Canada Post and other companies where I was showing how direct mail and physical printed items have an impact on memory a lot more than digital.
Really?
Yeah. And when used at a certain point in the sales cycle, in the communication cascade, or whatever you call it in marketing terms, using direct mail or print media cements an idea in a person's head a lot more. So if you're taking notes, you have a piece of paper, which you cannot get rid of. And I know I'm old school, but I still do that. I have,
like, notebook?
My actual notebook, which I left in the other room.
No, but I can get it.
I still take manual notes because for me, it works a lot better than to take, if I take notes on my phone, I close the app and I forget about it. But a piece of paper that sticks out from your purse, it depends, of course. You know, if it's a conference and if it's thoughts for the conference that you want to share back with the team.
Well, that's part of it,
Maybe those are okay, but for our own personal use, if we really care about remembering something, I would advise taking physical.
I'm interested in your finding about the direct mail piece. From the viewpoint of a marketer, would their best likelihood of engagement be then if they're doing multimedia campaigns that include print and online?
And I would look at, is it B2B, is it B2C? What is the typical communication pathway that you have and what is the call to action? Because if you send a direct mail piece pointing them to a URL, or you ask them to text something, or you're using multiple media like that, does that even make sense? Are you giving them enough time? Are you sending them email reminders? Are you sending another direct mail to remind them? Or what does that experience look like from the side of the customer? So I would always advise people or marketers, and this is something that I was doing a whole lot of when I was a marketer, I would put myself in the customer's shoes and I would run a campaign beforehand on me and members of the team.
Yes.
I wanted to see, you guys need to be in these people's shoes. Do you feel spammed? Do you feel like we're bugging you too much? Do you feel like we're interacting with you on enough channels? And besides just driving the call to action, does it make sense? Like, are we speaking human speak?
I know one of the challenges that I have as a podcaster is, from a podcasting point of view, if people will write a review on iTunes, you're going to get more visibility. And yet, if I'm listening to a podcast, I'm in a car, or I'm lying in bed with my eyes closed, I'm not going to start writing a review, and that's a real challenge for podcasters because it's the wrong way to get that review. We really need to set up a system where they can just do an audio review from their phone quickly. Which doesn't exist yet, but it's one of those things that I think we really need to do.
And there's also the fact that a positive experience does not stick out as much in a person's mind as a negative experience.
Yeah.
So you can go through life liking a lot of things, but you're not going to tweet about every single thing you like. You tweet about that bad experience at that restaurant or about that uninteresting direct mail piece you just received that doesn't, you know, it's dear client or whatever it is. So, and that
although if people are ecstatic, they will also share that. I mean, it's the extremes of emotion, I think, that lead to sharing.
Yeah. It happens less often, that's all.
Yeah, okay.
Like, people are much more likely to share their
frustration.
I think, and that's from an evolutionary perspective, we're wired to be like that. Negative experiences stick out in our minds. It's a survival mechanism.
They're likely
mechanism.
To be threatening experiences. Yeah. Okay. Anything else that you want to ask?
Well, you mentioned that you do a lot of work with digital marketing, digital media.
Yes.
There's a lot of lessons coming from neuromarketing about how to better market to people online.
Yes.
How to use personification. If you're sending an email campaign, an email blast, or if you are inviting them to a microsite, or if it's on Twitter, or if you're able to get their face on it and their name on it, makes a huge difference in open rates. You know, obviously, in the way you communicate, some words have a bigger impact on the brain than other words, depending on how they're being used. Action verbs, and these are, you know, regular lessons that marketers have been using, but they've been kind of learning it from, trial and error. Now we see a lot of things from science that we know contrast works really well for attracting attention. If you're a banner or an advertiser or faces can be used in a good way or a bad way. If you have your product next to a face, people will look at the face because we're, again, wired to look at faces.
So it can distract from
it
the actual product.
It can distract them, unless maybe you have the eye of the model looking at the product.
I read something about that,
Then the product will receive attention because our brain instinctively thinks, what is she looking at? there are some things, and we're wired to kind of scan the page in a certain way and pick up on these elements of contrast of faces. And there's tools out there that are very inexpensive, in a couple of hundreds of dollars, that even what we offer is basically an assessment of, at a glance, within 3 seconds, is that going to be noticed or is that going to be read?
What's your website address? I don't normally let people give a plug like that, but I'm interested.
It's okay. It's trueimpact.ca.
Okay, great.
Thank you. Yes.
I remember your comment about that when LinkedIn first started having ads that used your profile picture.
Yeah.
And wow, that really is eye-catching.
Yeah,
I suppose it can be a little creepy,
though.
I don't know.
You have to do it carefully because marketers know a lot more about their customers than the customers want to admit.
Yes.
So we cannot call somebody because, oh, we have your IP and you entered your email a while back, so I can see you've looked at five pages and you downloaded that thing. And
Yeah,
that would really creep people out. And you know, if you're doing lead generation in the early stages, phone kind of like calling and so on, I would be very sensitive about how you do disclose that.
Yeah.
You know, are you perhaps interested in this topic? Do you want
to
learn more about that? I'm just saying, like, randomly, oh, yeah, how did you guess? You know, that's kind of how you want it to go.
Yeah, and it's interesting because there are a lot of tools now that will, for instance, show me as a marketer when somebody looked at my email. And so I could phone them right away. And the research shows that, in fact, you do sell more that way.
Yeah.
But on the other hand, there is that ick factor, like, it just feels like I'm violating their privacy if I do something like that.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Unless you dance around it, unless you say, oh,
you
I was
pretend
just...
it was a coincidence.
Yeah. Or give them a few hours so that they don't feel necessarily.
Yeah.
I don't know. I mean, if most business people out there assume that that information is tracked, so I don't think they're surprised. I think if we're talking to a consumer audience, if it's a B2C kind of mailer, and, you know, that may be a little bit more sensitive. But any professional... by this time, expect that they're being
shocked
in some way,
Okay, well, thank you very much for the interview.
Problem.
I really appreciate it.
My name is Jeff Bardo, and I'm a trust strategist at Symantec.
Okay, and Jeff, we were talking about what should be the first steps for a small business that's thinking of getting into e-commerce, and they're worried about the security hassles, risks, dangers.
Right. One of the things that's actually a limiting thought.
Okay.
And part of the limitation is that it's focused on security. One of the things that a small business has working against it is this site, is this business even real? So there's a sense of legitimacy that needs to go along with the idea of you're safe, you're secure here.
Right.
Is this the real site is just as important as am I safe on this site too?
Well, and that's a challenge, too, because even when they have the trust seals, I mean, you can cut and paste those
right.
from anywhere.
Right, those could be images.
Yeah, sure.
So you want some kind of actionability about the trust seal or the trust mark.
Okay.
It says when you click on it, something happens. It reveals a layer of, and here's the due diligence that was done to validate that this is a real business.
Okay.
There's all sorts of things in a web browser that help you do that. You click on the padlock or the address bar, and it drops down something that says, this is a real site verified by blah, blah, blah.
Right.
Or you click on a trust seal, and it pops up something that says, this site was validated on this date by blah, blah, blah. Or some seals actually show the date and the time.
Mm-hmm.
So there's different ways of accomplishing that. This is real. It's real information. It's active right now.
Okay. All right. So they've got that.
Mm-hmm.
What else? I mean, so the seal, how do they even qualify to get the seal if it's a legit one?
Right. So there are instances where you can just go get a seal.
Okay. Yeah.
$19 gets you a seal. Great. It's a seal. Unfortunately, we've seen a lot of cases where in the idea of sending a message about trust or legitimacy, the site starts to look like a NASCAR car. Okay, it's logos all over the place. And like, okay, there's something wrong here.
Yeah.
It just looks ugly on a site to site. What a small business is looking for is someone who will deliver a security offering at the same time they're validating that the business is for real.
Yeah. Okay?
So there's, we call it, in the world that I work in of SSL, is the two functions are validation and encryption. Encryption is the security part.
Right.
Okay, protecting everything that goes between the browser and that site, and nobody else can read it. It's just gibberish to everybody else.
Right.
The validation part is where what a lot of businesses skimp on. Just give me the security part, thinking that they're going to get the validation part, and they don't. What you're looking for is someone who's going to or a certificate, a security product, a company who focuses on that validation part. They're going to check out you. Do you work at the company? Is the company legitimate? Is the address that you're at legitimate? All these kinds of things is the homework that the, in this case, the SSL provider is going to do in giving their stamp of approval, which is that trust seal.
Okay.
So then when you click on it, it reveals all that stuff.
Right.
It says, this is them, and they're located in, you know, wherever, Ontario, blah, 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 and it was validated on this date by blah, blah, blah. Those are the kinds of things that you can look for. There are specific product names that a small business would look for across the industry, and since I come from SSL, is the technologies that you're looking for are called either organization validation or extended validation.
And that, what does that mean?
They are what they say. So the typical thing that gets you just encryption is what's called domain validation. You, Tema, own the domain.
Right.
Org means, is the organization for real? Like, is it in Dun & Bradstreet? Is it in Hoover's? Is it registered with the government as being a real business entity?
Okay.
That's where the homework comes in for companies that are validating that it's a legitimate business.
Is BBB the Better Business Bureau? That's basically what they're known for.
They do a flavor of it. That gets you the seal on the site, but it's not a security product.
Right, okay.
So you're kind of missing part of the equation there.
Yeah.
Then you have to go get another thing that just does the security part, and then now you have two seals.
Right,
so
you're starting to get the NASCAR look.
Exactly,
okay.
You totally get it.
Okay.
There's a flavor above organ validation called extended validation. Doesn't really say what it is. That's the one that in a browser, it turns the address bar green.
Okay.
Which is cool, because consumers either intuitively or subconsciously get it. We've seen that the sites that display that are more inherently trusted. The user stays on that site, those sites longer. They feel better about interacting with those sites. Those sites are stickier. Drives more business to that site. So not only do you get the validation aspect, but the customer feels so much trust that I want to do more business with the site.
Of course, who knows what's cause and what's effect. Maybe the bigger, more secure, more safe organizations are the ones who are willing to invest in that.
Fair enough.
Okay.
There's a lot of small businesses, though, that will go and do that. As soon as they're registered, they're able to get that level of validation, because organizations like ours, the Online Trust Alliance, others that believe in the higher value of trust, advocate for that, because that sends the trust message that we want everybody to adopt.
Okay.
We're all in this together. This is the best you can do, and it's subconsciously or not accepted that this is a legitimate experience for you.
Right.
And it will pay you back.
Okay. So for a company, what is the cost like to get something like that?
It ranges wildly.
Okay.
The rule of thumb is you get what you pay for.
Okay.
You pay for higher levels of validation, and that you're going to be authenticated as a real place. It's really you. You own this, blah, blah, blah. You're actually an employee. That takes work on the provider's part. So therefore, it's going to cost you more.
Okay.
The range of that can go from, I quote U.S. prices, can go from $199 up to $1,500.
Okay.
Depending on the bells and whistles that you get with it.
Okay.
You don't go with the green bar and you go down a level, you could probably pay from $49 up to $1,000.
Okay.
Depending on what's coming with it.
Okay.
You get things like some degree of malware or vulnerability protection that comes with that, an extra layer of security.
Sure.
You're going to pay more for that.
Now, when a company hosts their e-commerce site on something like Shopify or Volution or whatever, are they getting the security as part of that? Part of the product?
They are. It's tricky, because they're offloading a business who signs up with that, which is a smart thing to do. I mean, let's let someone else handle
that.
Yeah,
exactly.
Right? Sometimes there's a security disconnect. The customer lands on the small business's site.
Yeah.
Sees, okay, I know you're working with this. I know this is the indicator you use. Semantic or McAfee or Better Business Bureau or whoever.
Yeah.
Google trusted site. They see the indicators. They see the green bar. Then suddenly they go to the e-commerce provider.
Right.
The shopping cart or the payment mechanism. And it's something else. Thing in the consumer's shoes.
Right.
I just got switched to a different site. Am I still on the same site?
Right. Right. Yeah.
So we talked about this with someone who came and just wanted general advice this morning. She's starting up an e-commerce site.
Right.
Make sure what you're doing for security
is consistent with
your partners. Exactly. Otherwise, the consumer's looking out for that kind of thing.
Right.
So it's a good tip, and it's a good thing to follow. You don't want to be led by the nose by your suppliers, but on the other hand, you don't want to break inconsistency. So there's a balance that you need to find between the two.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Any other words of advice that you would offer to businesses that are still in early stages of e-commerce?
Don't rush.
Okay.
Obviously, everybody has a business plan. You want to get through the business plan, get online, start making money, get to return on investment
sure.
as fast as you can.
Yeah.
Don't skip key steps, and trust has got to be a key step.
Okay.
These days, security, trust, privacy are so critical. They can't be left out of the process. They can't be out of design. They can't be out of the QA process either.
Right.
Someday, it's going to come, whether we like it or not, either a government entity or an industry entity is going to say, you must implement X, Y, and Z for security and trust and privacy. It's better just to design that in from the beginning. You'll be much better down the road. And we see this when we see small businesses come online, established businesses, they can actually compete on trust.
Yes.
That's not semantic talking. That is me and all the other members of the Online Trust Alliance who agree on the exact same thing.
Well, it's interesting because I also run a business called Web Mystery Shoppers. And, of course, in the mystery shopping business, there are so many scam artists out there.
Yes.
And so I'm amazed at how often I will get – I've always had a toll-free number for the business.
Yeah.
And I will get people phoning me just to make sure that I'm real.
They're doing the reverse validation.
Yeah.
That's really fascinating.
Yeah.
Well, good for them. They've learned.
Absolutely.
That you've got to talk to somebody and
test
it out. Absolutely.
Well, and I have stuff all over the website for the shoppers saying, you know,
right.
this is a scam. I've heard about that one. Like, I do try to keep them informed and educated.
Right. So that's actually a good point. So a tip that I would offer is to exude, to inspire, to project security and trust and privacy. Doesn't mean you just have to go buy stuff from people.
Right.
You can do stuff on your own. Like, explain on your site, this is how to know this is really me. This
right.
is how to know I sent you that email. I protect my passwords, and here's why.
Yeah.
So explaining that it's important to you sends a clear message about security and privacy and trust, which creates some affinity for your site, which eventually leads to higher business and higher traction and stickiness for your site.
Right.
It pays off.
Right.
But you got to start earlier. Kind of rules in that same message. There's also a lot of avenues where you just don't have to go buy stuff. There's things that you can just do.
Yeah, fair enough. Thank you.
With pleasure.
I hope you enjoyed those interviews. I have also aired some of the other interviews that I did at both those conferences. If you haven't seen them, just check back at the Frank Online Marketing Show page. So that's frankonlinemarketing.com/show. I got a really great reaction as well to the presentation that I did on Metrics Madness, really talking about the different types of measurements and metrics that we can use in the social media and digital media world, and what marketing researchers in particular need to know about those. I'll be putting together something for you about that soon. That's all for today. As always, if you have any feedback or comments, I'd love to hear them. You can always email me, Tema, T-E-M as in mother, A, at frankonlinemarketing.com, or you can call me toll-free at 1-866-544-9262. And as always, if you enjoy the show, please tell your friends about it, and go give it a quick review on iTunes or Stitcher. Thank you so much. Bye.